Hello and welcome to Imp's WWE Adventures podcast on the Social Suplex Podcast Network. You can help the network out by leaving us a 5-star review. You can also give a donation directly through Red Circle and become one of the amazing community by joining the Social Suplex Discord. Link is in the description. Listen to the other top-notch shows here on the Social Suplex Podcast Network, One Nation Radio, Keeping It Strong Style, All Things Elite, Wrestling Art with Chris Things, Trish and Sarah, and Tunnel Talk. My name is Matt Mayer, aka Imp, and this is your quick look back at the WWE week that was. 30 minutes talking WWE, but thinking of Danielson Ospreay the entire time. Still on the mind. Such a good match. And let's waste no time jumping on over to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to talk about Smackers. And an ordinary Smackers it certainly was. We built up to Lyon, France 4 Backlash. And the main event of the show was the WWE Women's Championship match, Bayley versus Naomi. Ending in the DQ was always destined to be. It's like, that's a shame. I wouldn't have minded this just being a straight up match and then maybe someone give Tiffany, just do something different. But nope, it's WWE's doing things, so that's the way we do things. Bayley versus Naomi. This version of Bayley may be great. And so far as her as champion, I feel like her presentation is clicking really quickly. A shift into babyface and now that into the champion, it feels like there's not a lot of work to be done to elevate her in the current state. She immediately feels like the champion of SmackDown. It's not the case they've gotten Raw where they've really got to work with Damian Priest. They haven't got to do any work with Bayley. Like, she's already there. But her Death Rebel theme is bargain bin bullshit. It's absolutely awful. Just starting off with the main theme, then her going role model. After it goes, which is, that's on par with the disc scratch. I bet you're wondering how we got here. Just as the music goes down, like, and then goes role model into and into a new theme. Like, if you're going to do a one-off with her special Egyptian entrance at WrestleMania, then sure, you can do it like that. However, you don't do the role model with a hero babyface champion. It's not the music befitting of it at all. And of course, it plays into the genericness of the Death Rebel themes where they all just have to say the thing at the start. And even Damien Priest one, which is you're somewhat riffing off of Alter Bridge and yeah, Death Rebel are not Alter Bridge. But even that is like, all rise for the Judgment Day. And at least with Damien Priest 1, it continues through the themes. That's like the normal lyrics over the guitar riff. But, oh God, generic and formulaic at the same time. I talked about this last week. Yeah, Bayley's theme is just awful. But the match itself was given 10 minutes to actually build something. Bayley limping with a tweaked right knee. Naomi with a seemingly constant stream of innovative springings. A nice and unexpected strike exchange to launch us into the final flow. Bayley challenging Naomi to bring it, elevating to the outside, and a Bayley to belly onto the announce table. And this is where it became the DQ it was always destined to be. Tiffany Stratton with the stiff forearm, no damage control this time. Both lasses into the ring for the prettiest moonsault ever, hit perfectly onto both of them. But it's a show-ending DQ of Tiffany Stratton, like, this is my time type of thing. I do like that this was in the main event in terms of giving it prestige and credence to the women's title. I feel like that kind of placement was great for it. And of course, you had the number one contender with LA Knight and AJ Styles. So it kind of made sense in my head that had already been given some prestige of being the main event last week. You can have it start off first and it still feels like it's got weight to it. Whilst this placing the women's title match added weight to the women's title match, which was great. However, it was always going to end like this. It just means you're ending on an angle that's not that hot. And it's telling Tiffany Stratton that the fans want to see elevated from where she currently is. I mean that in a good way, because she's been elevated at the right pace. But it's one of those where they haven't been given that huge investment into the character yet, so it doesn't feel like a huge angle. It feels like it's nice. It's fine. Like, whatever. And if the title match is always going to end in DQ, I'll always vote against putting it in the main event. You can start with that match. But I do agree, if you're trying to add prestige to all of your titles across the show, it makes sense for them to rotate which one is main eventing, especially when you've got a number one contenders match or you've got a world title match. You always put the world title match in the main event. However, you also take your own booking into consideration. So this is more of like a personal taste where I don't like ending a show on a DQ finish. But I did like you had the damage control people and Bianca and Jade out in the crowd, so you had different dynamics in the background at play. But in terms of like the actual what's happening in the ring, it didn't feel like the angle should have been invented, even though it did feel like the title should have. So that's where my nerdy little critique kind of comes in. But that kind of felt like the way the SmackDown ended felt like it was representative of the rest of SmackDown. Well, you had your two big matches bookended the show. but I wouldn't particularly say there was a lot to write home about. Like, it was a show that happened, and then we all moved on with our lives. Apart from people like me who make notes, and I'm going to talk about it on a microphone for like 10-20 minutes. But let's go through the rest of the show. There's a few like decent things built up throughout it. Yeah, Solo Sokoa's got new threads. Yeah, did he look cool in his new tailored outfit, his new tailored fit? Introducing Tamata Hayman as my MFT. I'm British and I'm white, I don't know what that means. Don't worry if you missed it the first time though, they made sure to repeat that information like we were in the Vince McMahon scripting regularity era. Oh, because he made sure Michael Cole said those key words over and over and over into your head to a point where, like, ad nauseum. Reaching that point of like, okay, get it, Michael, can you stop saying it, please? But I know, Vince wouldn't let him. He had to keep saying it. I love the Wise Man's transition into being the most scared by Sokoa of them all. The crowd playing perfectly into the Bloodline drama, chanting we want Roman, and we're only in week two. It was like, well, yes, that is eventually where we're going, correct, well done. But can't you let us, you know, get there before you start fully swinging into what we know the end goal is going to be in terms of this Bloodline version of Roman the Tribal Chief character becoming babyface. And it's just interesting that the crowd are already being like, we know where you're going. We're chanting for Roman and are still wanting to show WWE, hey, look, we know where you're going. Aren't we clever? And I'm just like, but I like where it's going. Like, could you not talk yourself out of this? It's looking perfectly fine. I don't trust WWE to not do a change on a thing because it got predicted. It's like, no, I feel like you stick with it. Triple H has shown, like with the whole Cody booking, I think he's shown that he is capable of just giving us the standard thing that was going to be all along and not swerving to try and swerve the crowd like Vince used to do. Like, if this happened in WWE in the Vince era, there was something else would happen to be like, I swerved you, I'm actually cleverer than you. Well, Triple H is just like, if you predict it, if you chant we want Roman, we're not going to change it all up just to swerve you. We're going to give you the thing because you've told if you want it. Like, you know what? Yes. But I do like that this whole story, the whole point of it is to get you to the point of chanting we want Roman. And they're doing it on week two. You're going to be slowly manoeuvred into chanting that. Like gradual manipulations over the course of weeks to make sure you're definitely chanting it. And this crowd sees it a mile off and immediately chants it. It's like, you know what? You conditioned your crowd well, where even just with a basic thing, they're immediately chanting the thing that you were going to be building to anyway. So kudos to that. Kevin Owens, the man in the Bloodline sights, solo introducing Tama Tonga, only for a bloody Kevin Owens to be thrown onto the ramp. Or what happened? A cold bad guy striding to the ring and silently raising his wand. The good guy has not come over to the WWE. It's not the good guy that we were seeing in New Japan. KO, unwisely, running back out with his fight, giving the man some agency in this new Bloodline beatdown. Really building Tama as the son of Haku. That's the thing repeated every single time on commentary. The son of one of the biggest badasses in wrestling. He's Solo Savage. Now Sokoa isn't Roman's daunting silent figure. He gets one of his own. I do like, he is mirroring off of the guy that he has learnt from. After the break, Heyman in shock, Aldis taking the wise man into the parking lot, giving us the full picture. Two rental cars crashed into each other. They genuinely rented two rental cars and genuinely crashed them into each other. KO's bloody state making sense with us now, learning Tonga crashed into his car. I loved this order of the segments. Because sure, we could have had Byron Saxon in the parking lot being like, and I'm waiting to interview Kevin Owens. Oh look, here's his car now. Hey Kevin! And then bang. And then you do the Bloodline segment and Kevin Owens comes out and fights or whatever. You can do it linear. However, I really liked this order of events. Where you saw him beat him up, and I think you would just assume that Tama Tonga's done a vicious beatdown. The way that they had Tama do the beatdown in the ring, where he's headbutting him. Corey Graves is really getting over the savageness of the beatdown on commentary as you're watching him just headbutt the poor Canadian. So you just assume, oh, maybe he did something violent backstage. We just didn't see it. Then you see what actually happened. And there's nothing stronger than the image of the mind, where you are not shown the car crash, but you're shown the aftermath. And then in your mind, you will picture it being way more vicious than it ever would have been if they'd actually shown it happening in real time. Later in the show, we got more Nick Aldis as he brought out Triple H to get rid of the blue tag belts. Got to get rid of all those past weird Vinceisms in terms of the belts and everything. The new WWE Tag Team Championships looking far, far better. It's not even close. This was one of the most, most beautiful. It's taken good inspiration from the tag belts from like the 2006 era. just in terms of like the shape of the belt, and it's brought in the modern design and put the WWE logo isn't like all encompassing on it. It doesn't look like a toy. It actually looks like a title. And I think that's my main praise for all of the new championships. Because of course the belts on Raw have all got the same style. They've got a very identifiable house style for all of the Raw belts. Whilst the ones on SmackDown, the world titles look the same. But now you've got identifiable differences with the tag belts and the United States Championship as well, which is great to see. This led us into crowning our new number one contender, Street Profits versus New Catch Republic versus Legado de Fantasma versus AOP. Fun pacey tag. Not really a lot more to say. Big boys AOP laying waste as Waller grimaces at ringside into the ad break. Big strong boy Bate tries his best, but with the help of Dunn and the Profits, he was able to live out his whirling dreams. Spin a big boy over on his shoulders. A really good spot at one point with lots of lads in the corner. Berto tags himself in during all of that chaos, building to an awesome looking top rope dropkick powerbomb combo. Really love that. All the lads ganging up on AOP to send us into the final flow. But with four teams, there's always a bugger to break up your pin. A top spot with Dunn and Bate moonsaulting off the turnbuckles to ringside, followed by Ford flying out with a tope over the ring post. Springboard moonsault from Garza, the pin broken by a Ford from the heavens, Dawkins in to secure the win, with their finisher, that what be called the Revelation, which I thought would just be the name of the finisher for either AOP or people in the Final Testament. It's a very Final Testament-y name for a finisher for your actual completely different faction to have. Perfectly fine tag match. But the last thing I want to talk about is LA Knight versus AJ Styles, the number one contender for the WWE Undisputed Universal Championship. It kicked off the show in Styles. what a bad joke. Do I leave that in? Yeah, sure, why not? Given plenty of time, letting each lad showcase their flow, the back and forth playing off their growing familiarity as they keep facing each other. Since the build to the Royal Rumble, these two have just tangled in some manner. AJ winning with a wee little poke in the eye when he tried to stop Styles on the apron. Instead, sent back going, ah, positioning nicely for the phenomenal forearm. 1-2-3, AJ Styles wins and goes to France. It's all, when I'm watching this is all in my mind that AJ Styles is leaving relatively soon. Because there was the rumour that AJ Styles' contract isn't being renewed, or he's not taking on the new contract. He actually just wants to relax at home or whatever. We've heard wrestlers say that before. Majority of the time, they don't just sit at home. But you never know. You never know. AJ could have just reached that point where he's happy and he's perfectly fine to move on with his life. However, it's one of the things where I then see that he lost his theme and he's now got a Death Rebel bullshit and he's number one contender for Cody Rhodes to put him over as well. It's just like, these are all like little notes for a star that kind of actually is moving on. Just give him a little boost at the end to help put somebody over those last stages. But also, he's lost his theme. For me, that's the most telling thing, is when you lose that top theme and you get something generic, it's like, maybe actually there's some truth to this now. Like, if nothing had come out, I might have just thought it was a normal generic theme, but when you put the two together, it's like, you know what, I'm more likely to believe that because they've given him a crap theme. It's like, you know what, there's no point renewing the license for the music if you're going to leave. Anyway, that brings me to the end of Smackers. Perfectly fine, SmackDown, nothing really that crazy. Perfectly fine to move on to Monday Night Raw in Columbus, Ohio. So let's jump over to the red team.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Backed up into the corner. Here comes Morgan. Looking for oblivion. Caught by Becky. Bounces her face first. On the turnbuckle. Becky Lynch. Manhandle slam on the apron. Becky Lynch is the world champion.
And your new Women's World Champion. The real only established lass on Raw, with all the others in states of building, although like Liv and Nia aren't too far off. We're nearly there, but give Becky the belt and she can get both of them there. Instead of giving one of them the belt and only getting one of them elevated, use Becky to elevate them both. I mean, that's what I'm assuming they're going to do, because that's when I looked at the state and I was fantasy booking in my head, that's what I did. So when Becky won, I was like, oh, are they actually going to do that? But the main event of the show was the Women's World Championship Battle Royal, a show which I didn't really think that much of, and it didn't really feel like the Ohio crowd was that loud for. Sure, you can inject sound from the crowd, but what you can't inject is the feeling. So when I'm actively looking out at the crowd and I can see that they're not really going crazy for stuff, it felt like when AEW have visited Chicago one too many times. I mean, and the Chicago get a show, and this time they're just not quite as loud for it. This felt like a show where WWE had been to Ohio recently, and they weren't hungry for WWE yet. It felt like one of those crowds. Doesn't mean it was. It's just the vibe I got, and maybe that is just because the show itself was, you know, fine. There wasn't a lot to it, and one of the problems with Raw is when they're having a perfectly fine week, the show can feel like an absolute slog to get through. There's not a lot happening, and it's also really long. For me, that's the danger of the three-hour show. It's just that it feels so long, but feels long anyway, never mind when there's not a lot going on. And both SmackDown and Raw this week were both building weeks, so neither is particularly making massive plays. At least both shows did have women's title matches in the main events to kind of help elevate them. This one especially did a really good job of making it feel like a big deal, building up throughout the course of the show, and the presentation right before the match was all grand. Actually, I'll talk about the presentation immediately, where for me it was a perfect start. Becky receiving the single through backstage and gorilla camera shot, amping up perfectly to make this match feel like a big deal after a Raw that kind of just was. And he had Nia and Liv fighting backstage on a walkthrough. Becky gave a little amping up to Maxxine Dupri, who had her segment with Chad Gable a little earlier, and that leads into what Maxxine Dupri does in this match as well. Nia Jax, obviously built as the force to eliminate. A rough-looking elimination for Ivy Nile. Jax reaching over the top to swing her into the ring post. It's like, that's going to make her feel like a monster. Maxxine getting her little moment to shine after Lynch had hyped her backstage. Eliminating both Candice LeRae and Indy Hartwell. Building to her finding the confidence to step to Nia after Nile's elimination. Crowd buying into it as well, properly behind Maxxine Dupri. She stepped up to Nia Jax. But of course, that was a bit tad too optimistic to take on for Dupri. She immediately got eliminated by Jax. Showed that she could get the crowd behind her in a moment like that. So you as the fan, you've got something to bite into there. Little note, I loved the assisted cannonball spot from the Party Girls. Party Girls are an act where, as soon as their music starts playing, I put my hands on my head. It's like, make it stop. Make it stop. I hate this. Make it stop. I know we riff on the Death Rebel themes as just being generic and just a kind of crap. The Party Girls one is genuinely headache-inducing. Sure, it's not the party scene's not for me. Like, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. That loud music, it's not for me. It's absolutely not for me. And I can take that. I can understand that. But their music just gives me a headache. Like, stop. Stop it. Turn it off, please. A pissed off Piper Niven tearing into Lynch at ringside, onto the announce table, dragging out Nia and resulting in a drop onto the table. The spot calling over all of the referees to check on the safety of the lasses, meaning none of them saw Chelsea Green's elimination. I genuinely loved that. Just all of that nonsense with those three all brawling, and they all end up on the announce table, and after the Samoan drop spot, the referees all rush over to make sure they're fine, meaning nobody's looking at the ring. And in that, there's like a 5-10 second bit where Chelsea gets eliminated, has a quick look, then gets onto the apron and then back in. Obviously, it's wrestling cheesiness or whatever. Wrestling is inherently hokey. And I love it for it. I love spots like this. In the end, though, four lasses in the ring. Stark, Baszler, Jackson, Morgan. A faux final four with Becky Lynch down on the outside after that table spot. Giving Nia a couple more eliminations through those four to send us into her versus Liv and Becky. These three giving plenty of time to dance. And I looked at the clock, there's still 7 minutes left of the show whilst they were entering their to and fro. And I was just like, oh God, are they really going to let these three dance? What I didn't think about was how long they'd have Lynch celebrating. Taking both Lynch and Morgan's offense to eliminate Nia, taking us to the two favourites with a whole 5 minutes left of the show. I was like, oh God, they're really going to let... We had like 2-3 minutes with the triple threat, and now we've got full 5 minutes left of the show with just these two. Like, oh, they're going to give them plenty of time. And 2 minutes later, elimination teasers on the hard cam apron. In the end, Oblivion set up after a codebreaker with Becky Lynch stumbling backwards, only to be caught and manhandled slammed onto the hardest part of the ring. Ah, oh, no. Becky Lynch, the new women's world champion. For me, the perfect choice. Apparently celebrating the crowd after for what felt like half an hour. High fives and selfies with kids that just warm your heart all gooey. Just like with Sammy last week, this moment in the crowd was all produced so damn well. They really know now how to make it feel like she's in a sea of support. This with the cam angles that they're using. I say just with the camera angles, it's the cutting and everything to make it feel like you're in there within that sea of people, which Kevin never understood. But what I didn't know is it would be Becky Lynch's win would be so contentious. Just the reaction from certain subsections online. There's two things which are like huge falsehoods that much bigger demographics of WWE fans genuinely believe than I ever thought they would. The first of all is that Cody's black. It's like, how has this actually caught on? genuinely, how has this caught on as an actual thing? I was there when the joke started. When Cody Rhodes cut that crap promo against Anthony Ogogo. And the jokes all started. Those jokes were really funny. However, it somehow massively swung into him being actually black, and then after Swerve won the AEW Championship, there were genuine collages of all the champions being black champions. And it's like, there's no sense of irony or being in on the joke or whatever. It's like, no, because he genuinely is. It's like, no, he isn't. Yeah. So somehow that's one thing that's somehow become actually believed. WWE fans, maybe that's just an experiment that need to do, just drum up something within an AEW thing for somebody that might need to jump over long term, and when they make that jump over, just see if the lie starts to get believed or if the joke gets to be interpreted as genuine. The other one is that Becky Lynch is a selfish person that never puts anybody over, and I'm just like, am I watching the same performer as all of you guys? And sure, I could understand if this is like, I'll call them a normie, but a normie, a hardcore WWE fan that's never looked any deeper than what they're seeing in front of them and doesn't live online or whatever. But these are people who do live online, which makes it even weirder. They genuinely believe that. And I'm just like, the work I watched of Becky Lynch was her clearly, when her run as like NXT champion was clearly there to elevate so many people. And it did. Look what it did for Tiffany Stratton. Look what it did for so many people on Monday Night Raw when it's done for, as well with Lyra Valkyrie when she won. That she's, Becky Lynch is the one, her match with Tiffany Stratton is what helped make Tiffany Stratton. Then what got her so much support in NXT is then built her up and carried her over onto the main roster. Sure, Tiffany Stratton was also ready, but she was given that platform against Becky Lynch. And all of her work building up the Raw roster. And here as well, you saw it with her with the walking backstage and the way they were positioning her with her talking to Maxine Dupree to help like lift her up and give her the confidence. Just like, she's being positioned as a champion, which is that force of elevating everybody. And that is what is needed when you've got Nia Jax and Liv Morgan who are on the cusp of their characters being at that perfect point. But if they would have done it now, it wouldn't have been the right time. So why not give it to Becky Lynch and have her elevate both of them? It makes so much more sense in my head. And no, it doesn't mean they weren't elevated if they don't win the title and she just holds it until Ripley gets it. But in my head, it makes a lot more sense for Becky Lynch to have the title to help elevate Liv Morgan and help Liv Morgan just figure out this, I'm assuming, heel character of hers for Rhea Ripley returning as a huge babyface. Because I don't think they're going to have much of a choice when Ripley comes back. It may have been a slow turn across the summer anyway, but she's getting cheered so loudly when she comes back that maybe you do just have to turn her babyface, and that can really work with a heel champion Liv Morgan, which has been built up and figured out over the course of her chasing Becky Lynch. The Becky Lynch is selfish, doesn't put anybody over. It's just like with the Cody thing. It's like, how is this genuinely believed? What is happening here? This isn't real. It's not a thing. Anyway, let's quickly go through the rest of Raw. Even though it's 3 hours, I've got less notes than I do for SmackDown. There really wasn't a lot for me to say. There's the odd segment that I liked, and I've got like notes, but never what happened. But Jey Uso out, getting the chance to chat proper to the champion as challenger. The crowd happy to yeet, but they were hardly reacting to Priest at all. And this is what I was talking about earlier with Bayley. No more work really has to be done. She's already there. With Priest, he doesn't feel like a world champion. And around him, the title doesn't feel like a world championship title either. They've got a lot of work to be done. And this show did a lot of good groundwork to help position into that. Arguably, this is all work that really should have been done before he becomes world champion. But just positioning him within the group as somebody who's just got a lot more of a stronger say or position as like a leader style person. He doesn't have to be the actual leader. But he, as the world champion, really needed this just so he feels like a world champion. And it's my biggest critique of the Money in Bank stuff. Of course he doesn't feel like a world champion. It's the classic WWE case of not elevating the Money in the Bank holder at all because they're going to get that world title win. The one time they did elevate them in Dolph Ziggler got the hottest Money in the Bank cash in that I've ever seen. The him and Seth Rollins, two people who were genuinely elevated when they had the briefcase rather than keeping them mid-card, taking away momentum, and then they get the huge surge when they become world champion. They don't feel like a world champion when they do that. And it, for me, actively devalues world championship because you've then got to spend months building him up. And quite often, like we saw, I'll use Carmelo as an example. by the end of her reign, she actually felt like her character was figured out. It felt like it was great. However, by that point, they're ready to move on. And they're going to give it to someone genuine. It's just that it takes that many months for the character to actually feel like everything's clicking. It just makes their reign an initial climb to get over as champion, when it could have just gone smoothly, and Bayley's a great example. Hey, Vince is gone, but some of those WWE-isms still remain. Faced with the visage of being open, but he's a baddie, Mum! Telling a story of Jay whooping his ass so bad that Priest offered to go out and pay after, saying he earned it with respect during those bloodline times. That talking as an equal dies as soon as the champion brings the topic back to the title match in 2 weeks, calling Jay just the first in line to make him look good. The thing I did like was it did genuinely read into how we're all feeling looking at the match, and it at least tried to play off of that. Jey Uso having none of that, calling out that he's not even the leader of Judgment Day. Rhea Ripley is, and he's only world champion because he cashed in Money in the Bank. Both playing off of the genuine feelings, which is stuff that technically should work, but the big turning point was just the crowd just weren't reacting. They were reacting, they wanted to chant Yeet, but they weren't invested in the storyline before them, and they're not invested in Priest as world champion. They got a lot of work to do before them. Like, I'm not writing off the championship reign. It'll be stupid to write it off at this point. We're like 2 weeks in. but they've got a lot of work to do here at the starting point. A much needed note later in the show for Priest, showing before telling us that Dom and McDonut need Priest more than he needs them. A needed internal elevation within the Judgment Day for the champion, which I touched on a little bit earlier, but it's all good, it's all good. The World Tag Team Championship Awesome Truth versus DIY. Gargano in front of his hometown crowd, although they wanted to just partake in the R-Truth chance. They did not care for their own hometown guy. Not a lot to say with this tag match, really. Like, the Truth crushing finale for the win, which is R-Truth jumping up as The Miz hits his crushing finale. Gargano shaking their opponent's hands, Ciampa pissed off and refusing. Gunther! Actually, the next two things you got... I've got Gunther, I've got Drew McIntyre and Sheamus, and I've got Chad Gable. There's actually three things in a row that are all good character notes, but they are all little character notes and building rather than like a lot happening. These are all good shifting parts. It doesn't help the show not feel long, but they are all good shifting parts. Gunther showing his face for the first time since losing the Intercontinental Championship at WrestleMania. It's a brand new era. Whatever brand he's drafted to, he's no longer the Hunter champion. He's now the Hunter, just establishing that that's actually quite a dangerous thing. Officially announcing his participation in the King of the Ring tournament. It's time to make these tournaments actually mean something once again, after he did so with the IC title as well. New Day interrupting, bringing up Xavier's own King of the Ring victory. Gunther setting his sights on next adding prestige back to that tournament, using Woods winning as an example of exactly what he means. And this set up another New Day versus Imperium match. And no, I'm going to use video game rules here. Pointing out the thing that's a bit lame doesn't make it good because you're still having to do the lame thing. If in a video game someone goes, oh, not another fetch quest, when you are then going to do another fetch quest, doesn't make it good. You're still doing the thing. So Woods pointing out that we're getting yet another New Day Imperium match doesn't save it. It doesn't make it good. Still have to watch the match again. In the end, the baddies lost. Gunther angrily walking out. Kaiser beating up poor Vinci. In Gorilla, we see a happier Gunther smile. So finally, we saw Imperium explode. They've been teasing it for ages. They've, for some reason, wanting to do this for ages, and Gunther losing the title is an opportunity to finally do it. I don't know why. Got no idea why that would be the case. But obviously it's for some reason. The idea of Gunther smiling being the most terrifying thing of the entire segment. I do like that. Drew McIntyre out to chat shit. Immediate CM Punk chants. He had that four-way match for one, he says, fighting like a man, saying he's once again got his back to the wall because of CM Punk, whilst Jey Uso snuck in, stole the win like a coward, when out comes his long-term friend Sheamus, the one man who's going to be as brutally honest with Drew as the Scot believes he is with others, telling the hard truth, a one-armed CM Punk kicked your arse. I don't know why I did him as a pirate. Because I didn't want to do Irish. I didn't want to do offensive Irish. I decided to not do Irish, but then I still did the inflection at the end, so it just sounded like a pirate. It's all my own fault. McIntyre cutting him right back. Before you were injured, it was banger after banger after banger. But now it looks like it's been burger after burger after burger. And that genuinely made Sheamus laugh. Took him in a little while to actually compose himself. Did pretty well within the ring. And he's like, oh, your jokes have gotten pretty good. Well, I've been watching, they've been actually pretty funny. Responding with, I can lose weight, you can't lose stupid. A solid little meeting with Shamu meeting the current Drew for the first time, it being told plain and simple that that fights and pints era is done with. Leading into Sheamus versus Knackers, Drew watching from ringside, but doing nothing as Shinsuke delivers a knee launching off the barricade to the announce table draped Irishman, broke for the win in the end, but it would be a push to say McIntyre looked impressed as he at most golf clapped for Sheamus' win. Yep, they were playing off of the response to Sheamus' debut last week. Sheamus himself just being very honest, being just like, yeah, I've had nerve neck surgery. I wasn't meant to be back for a full month, but they wanted me back before the draft, so here I am a month before schedule after nerve neck surgery, so of course I'm not in 8-pack shape. It's like, yeah, understandable. I feel like in my head it was like, and moving on, but I did like how they lent into it here, just because it works for the Drew character where Drew believes he's being brutally honest with the others, but then Sheamus is like the one guy who's going to give it him right back. And I did really like that. Chad Gable with his first baddie promo after last week with the amazing angle with Sami Zayn. Out with the rest of the Alpha Academy. Hey, the rest of the Academy are still goodies, but Teacher Chad is the justified one. It should have been me celebrating with my daughter. I was wasting my time training these losers after running down each member of the Alpha Academy. Tazawa is a loser. Maxine, dumb as rocks, and Otis, you have proven yourself, without a shadow of a doubt, to be the biggest disappointment of them all. Impressively, the crowd fully bought into it. Like, oh, you can give him praise for a second. Like, no. you read the Roman thing on Friday, but Ohio, you were not ahead of them here. Phrasing it as honest feedback from a coach, changing focus by making the Academy's purpose to help him reach his goals. As a swing to the heel version of his character, I really liked everything about this. Also, gotta love the vibe of a faction held together under an abusive coach. Nothing more to read here. I'm sure there's no parallels or nearby influences this is drawing from. Nothing at all. Other notes for the show. Production-wise, it was nice to see the fancy 4K cameras whipped out for the in-ring title match announcing for the tag team match. Honestly, wasn't expecting any of that to be shown outside of WrestleMania. Like, I wasn't expecting it to show its face outside of the big events especially. So the fact we got it for a title match on Raw, I was like, oh, this is just how they present their title matches now. I was like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I like that. Also, a long single shot to ease us in after the ad break during the tag title match. Just an easygoing ringside framing as Cole runs down all the shit he's got to get through at light speed. Like, hey, if the commentators got a frantic amount to say and get through and we need our attention just so we can actually take in everything he's saying, the last thing you as a viewer would want is also a barrage of camera cuts. So the fact that it's one cut and you can actually pay attention to what Michael Cole is telling you. So instead of it just being like a, and we're back, and bang, 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 light speed. Like, no. We can take in the information, then we can get him into the faster cuts for the match itself. Bronson Reed with a baddie backstage babyface bashing on poor Sami Zayn. No fear, Jamie Noble and Kenny Dykstra were there to protect him. 2006 SmackDown out to save the day. And that is my final note for Monday Night Raw. A Raw that was, but a Raw that did do a lot of important character beats, and you would have seen without Mary B's injury, the women's side would have also seen just a decent character beat done there. I'm assuming for Liv Morgan. But that does bring me to the end of the show. Not an amazing WWE week to really talk about. This was AEW's week. This was Swerve Strickland's week. Huge congratulations to Swerve Strickland, who did show up on One Nation Radio on this very network this week. So if you want to go and listen to that, Rich, I'm pretty sure Rich clipped it onto the YouTube channel. So go watch it there too. Do go and subscribe to the YouTube channel as well. I do forget to plug the YouTube channel out of the many, many things. Anyway, with that, I say thank you for listening, liking, engaging in any form, any manner. Always appreciate it. Never take it for granted. I'll be back next week to talk about WWE as they get ready to set sail for Europe, whilst half of them are already in Europe doing England, and then they've got to switch to France. It's European time for the backlash. Oh, that's going to be the best thing about it. Like a 8 p.m. show start time for me. Oh, it's lovely. Sure, it's a Saturday, and I'm used to being able to have a Saturday and then WWE's in the middle of the night, so I'm not busy or anything, but yeah, it'll be an actual time, so I actually do lose the Saturday night. It's like, oh, okay, fine, whatever. But yes, I'll be back next week to talk more as they build up to France. So that, oh, it's also the draft. Shit. Forgot about that. In my head, it makes no sense to do a draft right before the pay-per-view, because you've got the matches booked for it, so surely you do it afterwards. But they like their draft to be these are the drafts that are going to happen, and then it kicks in on this date. Obviously, I prefer the first version I saw, but the first version I saw as a kid was the one in the mid-2000s where they had the fancy graphic with the faces of everybody over the other show's colours, and it felt like a genuine thing. It was a huge deal when somebody would change shows, and I felt like a big part of that was you had established people on each show that just didn't move over, which then meant you could do a huge play later down the line when one of those big guys move over. So you had long-term staying players, meaning when Triple H moved 2009, it's meant to be a big deal. Or it would have been if they hadn't done the John Cena double switch. Was that same year? I can't remember. Yeah, Vince killed that dead by his own bad booking stuff. Like, oh, okay, nothing matters. All right, sure, whatever. And the Superstar shake-up stuff was, that was a bad era. So yes, this feels like it's the first... Like, it felt like last time was Triple H just figuring out how to get everything stable and working properly with the draft. Well, this feels like, no, we are in a Triple H era. This is a genuine first time when it really does feel like this is a genuine Triple H era draft. So here, look at me calling it the Triple H era. It's already kicked in. Cody's suggestion of calling it the Renaissance era, immediately dead. It's like, nah, we can't use that as marketing stuff. Like, we need something just to really tie that bond from the viewers to Triple H, so that there's a huge fuss kicked up if he's named in the trial that's going to be happening with the Janelle Grant stuff. Like, oh yeah, if anything bad happens to that, there's going to be a huge fervor kicked up because the fans have such a connection to Triple H specifically. Is that? Yeah. Anyway, listen to Trish and Sarah talking about all of that. Anyways, with that, I bid you adieu. I'll be back next week. I bid you adieu. Adios.